The following is a rebroadcast.
This is Common Ground, a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. This week we're talking about the role diamonds have played in modern South Africa. So do you think this white diamond cartel is going to outlast the white government in South Africa?
Unquestionably. I think what's going to happen is that there won't be any real peace with De Beers until they can move South African blacks into positions of management. I mean, it's all very well to say we'll pay a black miner a decent wage.
Common Ground is produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. Here in New York City, far from the diamond mines and the heart of the De Beers Diamond Empire, is one of the busiest diamond exchanges in the world. New York's Diamond District is only one city block long, but I'm told there are about 4,000 different diamond dealers on this one block. Every shop window along the way is filled with glittering diamonds and other precious jewels of all sizes. It's a sunny day in Manhattan, and many jewelers are standing outside their doorways, ready to talk diamonds with any interested passerby. So if you were to add up the value of all the diamonds on this block, what do you think it would be?
Too much money. Too much money. I mean, taking into account that I have about $2 million just in my little window here. I mean, there you go to a guy like Siegelson's window, and half his window is worth that much.
Well, one thing I was wondering about is, I mean, you always hear about De Beers in South Africa as controlling diamonds, but you don't see their name here.
No, well, they have nothing to do with the retail end of the business. They have to do with the manufacturing, and when people go overseas to buy diamonds, a lot of times, you gotta understand, De Beers controls the mines. They don't necessarily control the manufacturers or the people who cut the diamonds into rough. So that's kind
of it. Well, as this dealer says, this is just the retail end of the diamond industry. For our story, we go back to the source of the diamonds and the hub of the modern industry, South Africa. Journalist Stefan Kamfer has just published a book about this most enduring of empires, the one created by Cecil Rhodes and known to the world by its company name, De Beers. Kamfer is a contributing editor at Time magazine. His book is called The Last Empire, De Beers, Diamonds, and the World. Kamfer begins the story with the discovery of diamonds in South Africa in the mid-19th century, a time when South Africa was not of much importance in the British Empire.
Really, there was no South Africa as we know it, just a sere, dry, uninteresting land that England had acquired to keep Napoleon from refueling his ships at the southern tip of Africa. And then in 1867, a Boer farm, actually Boer does mean farm in Dutch, but it was a farm boy, bent down and saw a pretty pebble in the banks of the Vaal River. He picked it up and gave it to his mother, who thought it was really nice, and put it on the shelf. Somebody came by and said, "I think that's a diamond." Everybody said, "Nonsense, there's no diamonds in Africa, they're all in Brazil." If you look geologically, if you look at a map, you will see that Brazil must have at one point been attached to the continent of Africa. I mean, Brazil is convex at that point, Africa is concave at that point, they fit perfectly. So it's logical, after the fact, to see that Africa and South America were once not only intertwined, but probably geologically very similar. In any case, the little pebble was shopped around. It turned out to be a diamond. The diamond rush was on a couple of years later, and by 1875, the big hole, as we call it in Kimberley, this huge, huge man-made hole, was being dug up, and there were all kinds of contradictory claims. Everybody who had a little piece of turf called it a diamond mine. and a man named Cecil Rhodes finally consolidated them under the name De Beers. Cecil Rhodes we know of because Rhodesia was named for him, and also because
Rhodes
our president
Scholar.
Has a Rhodes Scholarship, indeed. In fact, somebody once asked me whether it was really right to accept a Rhodes Scholarship, since Rhodes was such a racist and such an imperialist, but those were different times. In any case, he was the imperialist extraordinaire. He really believed at one point that everything should be united under the British flag from Cape to Cairo, meaning from the Cape of Good Hope all the way north to Egypt under the English. Needless to say, this did not happen, but he was able to get Rhodesia named for him, and he was able to be the prime minister of the Cape Colony while he was CEO of De Beers. Can you imagine such a thing happening? It would be as if Clinton were the head of General Motors. But they saw no conflict of interest at De Beers, and that's how the company began.
Now, how was he able to consolidate everything under his power?
He was able to convince people to sell to him. He paid whatever price they wanted. He believed that every man, and believe me, at that point there were no women around, had his price. And sometimes the price was money, sometimes the price was land, sometimes the price was reputation, sometimes the price was women. Whatever it was, he managed to come up with it. He also believed that the way to keep the price of diamonds high was to keep them scarce and not flood the market. And that has been De Beers' hallmark ever since. Diamonds are truly not scarce. There's lots and lots of diamonds, but we don't see very many of them because De Beers, which then entered the modern era with Rhodes' death in 1902, has always been very, very careful to acquire diamond mines or leases for diamond mines everywhere. That includes Australia, it includes the black nations of Africa, and it includes the Soviet Union, all of which dealt with De Beers, even though they decried apartheid at the UN and so on. In the meantime, the USSR was feeding the diamonds under the table to De Beers, and so were the black nations of Africa, because they could get a better price. If they went outside, they wouldn't get the price, and money, apparently, talks very loud.
So everyone saw it in their interest to deal with De Beers in De Beers' terms.
They did, and De Beers has really the last true cartel. I mean, OPEC likes to think of itself as a cartel, but in fact, there are always defectors. You know, Nigeria will go out during the 1973 Yom Kippur War, the Shah of Iran sold oil to Israel right through the war. I mean, it is a cartel full of holes. It's as porous as a colander. De Beers controls close to 90% of the world's diamonds, and there are no defectors. They're having some trouble now in Angola because Angola is civil chaos, and there are just a lot of pirates there digging up diamonds and flooding the market. But it's a very small portion of what the true diamond market is, and that's always been tightly controlled by De Beers and what they call the pipeline.
And given De Beers' history, do you have any doubt that they will be able to control the diamond situation in Angola?
Eventually they will, because eventually there'll be a civil government and then they will deal with them. Australia, when they discovered diamonds, interestingly enough, they were found at a place called Kimberley, which is just coincidentally named for the Kimberley in South Africa, which is where the big hole was first dug. Originally, the Australians wanted to sell their diamonds on the outside, didn't want to deal with De Beers, and the head of De Beers, a man named Harry Oppenheimer, was able to convince them otherwise. The Oppenheimers have been really the controlling family of De Beers since Sir Ernest Oppenheimer got on the board of De Beers and became its CEO, and really then began the ruthless techniques that they've used. For example, they also have a sister company called Anglo-American, and Anglo-American deals in gold and uranium and real estate and insurance and fruit farms and so on. They have an enormous amount of money, and De Beers' biggest stockholder is Anglo-American, and Anglo-American's biggest stockholder is De Beers. They own pieces of each other, so it's almost impossible to trace the monies and see how it works. And for example, when the black nations of Africa, like Sierra Leone, traded their diamonds, they did so through companies licensed outside South Africa. If you were dealing with a company licensed, for example, in the Bahamas or Liechtenstein, it would be very easy for you to say, our hands are clean. Then through a series of steps, they'd go from Liechtenstein to someplace else, and back to Anglo-American and back to De Beers in a very complicated maze, so that everyone's hands appeared to be clean, and certainly it was the best laundering operation in the world.
In The Last Empire, you talk about Cecil Rhodes's political speeches and say that those are what framed South Africa's or Africa's racial policies for the next 100 years.
Well, that really is the crux of the South African dilemma. Originally, there were actually a few blacks who owned diamond mines, owned claims for diamond mines, and Rhodes needed cheap black labor. Because diamond mining, unlike gold mining, which also needs labor, but diamonds cannot be melted down and reclaimed later. Each one has to be plucked out of the earth. It's very labor intensive. And so what he proceeded to do with the help of the British government was essentially to deplete the farming economies of the surrounding tribal areas. And then those tribal men had no place else to go for money except the mines. They paid a living wage, barely a living wage. And he promoted the first racial laws, which called for passes, which meant that blacks had to account for themselves at all times. They were not wanted in the white areas. They were not allowed to wander anywhere. They were essentially imprisoned in compounds. And compounds were only for black males, so their families were sometimes hundreds of miles away. And they were in these 3 to 6 month contracts when they couldn't do anything except work in the mines under very undignified conditions. They were searched all the time. They were often nude. They were given purges and so on. And what happened was that essentially the tribal traditions in Africa were broken forever. And the family was broken. And it was a form of slavery, even though slavery had been outlawed in Britain in 1837, long before the United States outlawed it. But this was de facto slavery. And eventually, after Rhodes' death, when the Afrikaner right got hold of the government, which is really after World War II, they wrote all of these prejudices into hard law, the Grand Apartheid. And then there was petty apartheid, too. Grand apartheid meant that blacks could not vote, had no prayer of getting into business of any kind, that they were forced on lands of the whites' choosing, and so on, even though they were they outnumbered the whites 6-1. And so all of that came out of the diamond mines, because there was no policy of any kind from England until suddenly money became a factor, and diamonds and gold became factors. The other aspect of this, of course, is gold, which also needed cheap black labor and needed compounds. And so gold built a city called Johannesburg. And in 1875, there was no Johannesburg. In 1880, there was a city with high-rise buildings for that time, electric lights and tram cars before New York had them.
How were they able to justify these policies?
It's amazing what rationales can do. They justified it by saying that actually they were helping the blacks to enter the civilized world by teaching them the law, by teaching them a skill, by teaching them to get along in the Western world. In fact, of course, it was quite the opposite. And they always said, and Rhodes was one of the first, as soon as they become, you know, civilized and attuned to our ways, well, of course they'll be able to vote and they'll be able to enter our society. They never did. And as a matter of fact, almost 100 years later, Harry Oppenheimer, who was the CEO of De Beers after his father, Sir Ernest, died, said that he really still didn't believe in one man, one vote. He said there was a good idea sometime, but he put an ad in the New York Times saying we're not ready for it yet. And the yet was always the big question.
How long ago was that?
Well, that was probably 25 years ago or so. Harry Oppenheimer was always, interestingly enough, opposed to apartheid, not on moral reasons, but he knew that it would not work because all it was going to do is divide his nation further and further and bring it further and further, farther and farther from the national community, international community he saw was beginning to lean heavily, and eventually that there would be sanctions. And of course he dreaded that. So if he just thought apartheid was bad business, which of course it's turned out to be.
The Oppenheimers in general like to cultivate this enlightened image as opposed to the more hardline Afrikaners in South Africa.
Well, strangely enough, they are. I mean, the basis of comparison always has to be made there and not here. I mean, for example, I was in Johannesburg about 3 years ago, and I was seated at a restaurant where there were many blacks eating with what we were eating with blacks and whites, and the waiters were white, and they said, sir, to the black person. You wouldn't believe you were in South Africa. It was very, very integrated in the best sense of the word. There was no seething looks, no resentment that you could read on the part of the helper, anything like that. But then when you get up and you walk out, you realize that your black table mates can't vote. I mean, you're in another world. It's like antebellum South, or maybe the Reconstruction period. It's in some bizarre area. So you can't quite make the same comparisons. There was a man named General Smuts who was one of the founders of the UN. He used to argue for human rights at the UN. Of course, he didn't argue for them in South Africa, where he came from. But nonetheless, when he was defeated in the election, the Afrikaner right came in, and they were in dead opposition to people like Harry Oppenheimer. Because Harry, by comparison, looked like a liberal. To us, he would look very right-wing, but to them, he really seemed very dangerous. At one point, they, not the blacks, but they threatened to nationalize the mines because they thought Harry Oppenheimer was too dangerous. He was talking about integration in some, at some future time, and talking about better pay for his black workers for eventually bringing families into the areas where they're black men were working so that they wouldn't be isolated, all these kind of revolutionary notions. So Harry has always seemed to be on the left, and indeed he funded the United Party, which had one member only in Parliament, Helen Suzman, who was a very decent woman and always spoke out for the more idealistic aspects. At the same time, Harry Oppenheimer was using, and De Beers was using, and Anglo-American was using cheap black labor. And at one point, the ANC said, he talks about a multiracial government, but what he really wants is a multifacial government. You know, one face for the whites and one face for the blacks, and he could talk out of both sides of his mouth. But the fact is that De Beers, probably unlike any other company in South Africa, has been able to change. And right now, for example, they pay equal wages for equal work, whites and blacks. Unheard of. This is unheard of in South Africa, and he's done it.
When did they start doing that?
Within the last couple of years. And they have always interested themselves in trying to get the black unions working, because they would rather negotiate with a union than negotiate with chaos. So actually, they've been very pro-union through all this, strangely enough. So it's a very contradictory company, but it's a company that, it's the only one I know of that has been able to change. Granted, there's a gun to their head, but there are a lot of other places that have guns to their heads that haven't been able to change, and we can name them here. I mean, they have a great secret in De Beers, and that is called the scenario. They have a team of scenario writers always trying to predict what's about to happen to them. And there's no, I don't know, you know, if you look at American companies, you look at IBM, they couldn't predict that the mainframe was no longer going to be valid and that the PC was going to take over. GM never foresaw the Japanese incursion until it was almost too late. AT&T never foresaw its own breakup. They never believed it would happen. De Beers has always been able to look at the most disastrous scenario. I've seen them. They have three scenarios written for the coming era. And they have the really hellish scenario, which is, you know, that it becomes Lebanon, that you have black-on-black violence, tribal terror, the kind of things that go on in some townships even now. Then they have the sunny scenario, the heaven scenario, in which the blacks and whites go off hand-in-hand into the sunset, which we know isn't going to happen. Then they have the very brutally realistic scenario, in which they realize they're going to be put under a lot of pressure. They're going to have to start offering stock to their employees, which they have been doing. As I said, equal wages. They're going to have to work with Cyril Ramaphosa, who really is, I think, much more of a power than Mandela, who is essentially a figurehead, although an extremely important one. They'll do all that. When Mandela got out of jail, the first white industrialist he wanted to see was Harry Oppenheimer. So they're able to forecast and to try to predict, and it's something that they really are to be congratulated for in the middle of all this, because at least they are able to change because of it. They plan their change, they'll do whatever is necessary to survive.
The program you're listening to is Common Ground. It's sponsored by the Stanley Foundation. My guest is Stefan Canfer, a contributing editor to Time magazine and author most recently of The Last Empire, De Beers, Diamonds, and the World. The Stanley Foundation sponsors a broad range of activities, from policy conferences to programs for educators to facilitate dialogue about world affairs. So do you think this white diamond cartel is going to outlast the white government in South Africa?
Unquestionably. I think what's going to happen is that there won't be any real peace with De Beers until they can move South African blacks into positions of management. I mean, it's all very well to say we'll pay a black miner a decent wage, but until you have blacks at the heads of these corporate divisions and start earning the big money and start participating in the life of De Beers and Anglo-American, that's going to be an internal war. But again, I think they're doing that. What they have to do is recruit more avidly, and I think they've begun to do that as well. I think that they'll outlast the government because they have so much expertise managerially in mining and so on. I mean, it really would be impossible to nationalize them and make it work. They have an incredibly complicated network. As I said, so much so that the Soviet Union and the black nations would work with it. They control everything from the mouth of the diamond mine all the way to the retail end. They're not retailers, but every retailer plays ball with them.
And how about their power on the political level in South Africa? How much influence do they have on the present government?
Well, there are two aspects of that. I think they have very little. They had almost no influence on the Afrikaner right. In fact, the prime ministers wouldn't even see Harry Oppenheimer. With the de Klerk, it's somewhat different, but the firing line has nothing to do with de Beers. Where de Beers is really important is that between de Beers and Anglo-American, they control about 45% of the Johannesburg stock market, which is a major stock market. We don't think of it that way, but it is. It's very big, and it's gold and diamonds and uranium and many other things. When a government is in trouble financially, which is what happened to the South African government when sanctions began to bite, they need local business to work with them. And I think that you will find Anglo-American being much more important in the black or the multiracial government than they have been in the past, because I think that Mandela and, more importantly, his younger colleagues will welcome this. I think they'll want to work together. They don't want a revolution in their hands. They don't want to go Marxist. I mean, there's Slovo, who is a Marxist in the government, but they're not going to go left. They've got the example of Eastern Europe before them, and they can see that China is moving toward a free market and Soviet Union and so on. They want to keep their businesses healthy. They just want to be a part of those businesses, and I think that's likely to happen.
For such a powerful cartel, they certainly seem to manage a low profile. You never hear about them in all the stories about South Africa.
Yes, it's funny that you say that, because I have always felt, and I think I could prove it, that unlike almost any other family, the Oppenheimers pay their public relations concerns enormous amounts of money to keep their name out of the paper. I mean, they don't want. Occasionally, there's a wedding or something, and then it's covered in the press. Other than that, no. Harry Oppenheimer lives in a very beautiful estate in Brenthurst, outside Johannesburg, but it is not ostentatious. They live grandly in a certain kind of way, but there are many movie stars who live more opulent and invisible lives. They don't. That's not what they want. They're rather like Cecil Rhodes, who said, "Let others wear the finery and let others be gaudy. I'm interested in the power." And that's what the Oppenheimers are interested in. They're interested in power. They're interested in doing big things. They don't like to acquire businesses. They like to build businesses. That's always been part of their guiding principle.
Well, their whole history is such a study for people who want to know how to do things right. I mean, low profile, and then their ability to market. I found the marketing campaign you wrote about that occurred in the right after World War II to be just fascinating.
Well, it is. For example, they are really not allowed to have an office in the United States because they violate the Sherman Antitrust Act. They are a cartel. Now, other businesses would have said, "Okay, thank you very much, goodbye." Not De Beers. They said, "Okay, we won't be here, but our advertising agency will be here." So they found an agency named NWA, which is a Philadelphia agency, sizable, but not one of the big headline agencies. And in 1948, a copywriter concocted the slogan, "A diamond is forever." Now, if you think about it, quartz is forever, the granite is forever. The pebble you picked up on the beach this summer is forever. But somehow it caught on, because diamonds have always had a romantic image. They're in the Arabian Nights, and they're in the Bible, and so on. And there are other aspects of diamonds. It is the hardest substance on earth. It glitters in a different way, but they're not forever. And if you hit a diamond with a hammer, it'll shatter just like granite, into worthless pieces. But it caught on, and it was a relentless campaign that they began, and it happened that our economy was recovering at that point from the war. And so once again, diamonds became a part of American life. And interestingly enough, they saw that in Japan, they had a market before the war, 1%, I think 2% of Japanese women got fiancés got diamonds for their engagement Now 80% do because of the De Beers campaign. I mean, they are very, very good promoters. They'll do it subliminally too. They'll take a movie like Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and push Diamonds Are Girls' Best Friend, or they'll use the James Bond movie Diamonds Are Forever and they'll ride in on that. They will supply diamonds to movie stars for the movie role. Burl Oberon is famous for wearing diamond rings and tiaras and all that from De Beers, and they'll do this in England. They'll supply diamonds to royalty when Queen Elizabeth was Princess Elizabeth and visited South Africa. She received diamonds. Many photographs about that, and all. That's what they're very good at promotion and promotion of the legend of diamonds.
So you really can't separate all the current political turmoil in South Africa from this history of diamonds, can you?
De Beers has a lot of shadows on their history, and it won't do simply to say, well, look what we are now. We're this liberal organization. They are stained with their reputation, with their misuse and use of cheap black labor, and the manner in which they talked two party lines, one the liberal one, one the user one, and they will have to live with that. And yet, I think it serves no purpose to keep throwing the past back at people forever. I mean, I really do believe what Dr. King said, that is, you know, if you have a real eye for an eye, situation, you both wind up blind. It is probably to some degree guilt and some degree pure pragmatic good sense that has made De Beers turn toward the ANC and toward this government and say, let's work together. We have an awful lot of power. It would be a shame for you to blow all this. We've seen what's happened in some of the other liberated black nations who have not been able to get stability and control. Why not work together? We will, as fast as we can, accommodate your needs, but we don't want to be nationalized. We don't want to be brutalized. We don't want to be made the whipping boy of some new establishment because we have had a sullied past. And I think that's likely to happen. There's sensible people at the ANC, and rather sweet. It's amazing to me how many, you know, you keep hearing this awful violence, but it's amazing when you talk to blacks in South Africa who've, you know, suffered incalculable insults and sometimes murders, and how really nice they are. I think this is a result of that, something we simply don't have in America. They have an enormous patience. Africans have enormous patience. The clock will come, the clock will go. They're waiting for seasons and years. Eventually it will happen. You know, and they have that wonderful patience, something that I think probably has infected or in some way tinctured De Beers' outlook, because they're not in a hurry either. They can wait it out.
Journalist Stefan Canfer has been my guest on Common Ground. He's the author of The Last Empire, Diamonds, De Beers, and the World. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. If you'd like to order a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 for an audio cassette to Common Ground, show number 9416, care of Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. To order by credit card, you can call toll-free 1-800-824-5746. Again, that number for credit card orders is 1-800-824-5746, and ask for show number 9416. Our theme music was created by BJ Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.